Okay, there's this piece by Dennis called Radicality that was done in 1974. And I'd just like to talk about the piece and also the general idea that it brings up with the word radicality. And what I did is I made some notes, just a few pages. And I'll read these notes and to kind of get through them, and then we can just open it up to any comments about either the notes or the piece. And some of the things I think we've already talked about in the notes and discussed, but I'd also like to bring the talk kind of up to right now. There's a demonstration, I think, going on somewhere in the city. I don't hear it. I'm not sure if it's radical, but it's nevertheless happening today. And I just like to make it kind of like, you know, today as well. I mean, what this brings up as well as what it was in 1974. So I think I'm just going to read these notes. I met Dennis, by the way. I came to New York in 1970 from graduate school in Philadelphia. And the way I met Dennis was that there was a show in Oberlin, Ohio, by curated by a woman named Athena Speer, who was very, really kind of actually radical at the time, and for 1970. And curated a show at Oberlin College called Art in the Mind, and as far as I know, it was the first conceptual art show in the United States. It's the first time when it was kind of grouped together as a kind of a thing, conceptualism, in the United States. In Europe, I think there were some things done a bit earlier. And anyway, she had this show, and Vito Conchi was in the show. I think Dennis was in the show. But in any case, when I got to New York, I didn't know anyone, and Vito also put me in some kind of book that he was doing at the time. And so I called him up, and we got together and became friends and fairly quickly. And then he had a birthday party. Actually, figuring it out here, it was September 6th, 1970, which is Dennis's birthday. It was a birthday party for Dennis. And that's how I met Dennis, and became friends and stayed friends ever since. The other thing that we had in common, that we both showed at the same conceptual art gallery, which in this case was John Gibson. And John Gibson actually invented the terms earth art and body art and narrative art. And so we were showing this gallery for a time until we both went on to other galleries in the late 80s. We both realized that we would be completely and totally poor and starving if we kept with this gallery. And so I'm going to read these points, and feel free to comment, but maybe at the end of them we can just talk about some of them. The movements of modernity brought radicality to the table as they simultaneously reaffirmed the past. That's how you knew that whatever was art. Conceptual art was the last movement of modernism, as well as a bridge to the postmodern. That's why it was radical. There were two branches of conceptualism, and this is my terminology alone. I haven't heard it from anyone else, but this is what I feel. The two branches of radical conceptualism evolved, the Marxists and the Romantics, my terminology. There were a couple of Marxist Romantics and a couple of Romantic Marxists. Marx himself was a Romantic Marxist. Dennis's radicality was both radical and romantic. It was a landscape. The photo was taken at dusk, a romantic time of day, and it played with fire, a possible but not necessarily conscious allusion to Frederick Church's volcanoes. Marxist conceptualists of the 70s wanted to do away with the gallery system and the establishment. I'm not sure what alternatives they proposed. Romantic conceptualists were attracted to nature and to the impermanence of life. There is a sense of loss that the new materials brought to art through their impermanence. The radicality was in the materials. As far as I could see, Dennis may have been interested in changing the gallery system. But I doubt he was interested in eliminating the possibility of selling art. It's how we made our living. As far as the Marxists go, I'm not going to name names. But there was a kind of irony in their position. They made works that in themselves could not easily be transported or collected. So no more saleable works, no more galleries, and as the logic went, no more war, and consequently no more draft. This agenda seemed to be their primary motive. They also took photos of the ethereal works they did, and whether they liked it or not, the photos became saleable, the same as other art objects. This was an anomaly. At least I saw it as such. Actually, I was in a panel with Dennis and Vito at the Miró Foundation in Barcelona. And this came up, and Vito, as far as I remember, said, we kind of made a mistake. We shouldn't have done those photographs. But I don't think it was a mistake. I think it's great that we have these photographs left. But it was problematic in that political statement. It was not an anomaly of the Romantic conceptualists. The Romantics also made works that were ethereal and impermanent, perhaps in part to enjoy a sense of loss when the works disappeared. They took photographs to remember the so-called pieces, like we often take photographs of our children to remember them when they were children. Both Romantics and Marxists did not say no when someone wanted to buy a photograph or a drawing. Vito, recently, actually, I think it was last year, Dennis told me this, actually, sold his seedbed piece, performed January 15th to the 29th, 1972, to an Italian collector. Rumor is $250,000, which isn't too high, but it was seedbed. It was him masturbating underneath this ramp. What the collector got was the ramp. He didn't get Vito, and he might have gotten a tape. And by the way, you can only do that for so long. It becomes tiresome, and at some point, I have a feeling that a lot of people that were doing performances were trying to figure out a way how to get out of it for the future. Because unlike Chopin and Mozart and even the Beatles, you can have other people sing your songs. But performance artists seem to need to do it themselves. I did a couple performances at the time, just a few, in the early 70s. that had to do with, one was a song for a chin-up, one was a song for a slide, where the song was a metaphor for the action that was taken. Like the song for chin-up was low, high, low, and it was sung at the top of the bar. But I had people from Juilliard perform it. So in the future, it won't be diminished by me not doing it. But anyway, it was important, I think, that Vito did Seedbed. But, you know, you won't have that experience anymore, that primary experience of him doing it. And, of course, the very famous performance at the time by two people that didn't really follow the kind of visual semiotics of the 70s and really succeeded were Gilbert and George doing Underneath the Arches at Sonnenberg Gallery. But again, they can't do it forever. And to other people, I'm not sure if it'll be the same thing. Let's see. Semiotics is the semiotics of radicality. Semiotics is the study of signs, both linguistic and iconic. Its project is to understand how images and sounds of one physical manifestation, letters and two-dimensional images like photographs and paintings, for example, can come to mean something entirely different than what they look like or what they sound like. Like truck or fish, for example. We have the word fish. Sounded or spelled either way, it has no resemblance to a fish. But we know what it means. In other words, with language and photographs, you have a physical thing. There's some physical things there. And sorry. And you know, but this physical thing, really, you're thinking of some other physical thing. And the same with words. It's really pretty profound. Those squiggly little things that are on the board there, they just have nothing to do with what the thing looks like or sounds like, or it just, we know that it means that. And that's a lot what semiotics is about. But at the time we did not, the sign of a 70s radicality was the use of materials not previously associated with art. It was also the symbol of chaos. I mean, I really think that the thing that felt radical at the time was that there was these materials that were coded as being art materials, like oil paints, stretchers, canvases, bronze. And it doesn't seem to matter. But then it felt transgressive to kind of use something else, like fire. And by the way, I think with most of the quotation marks earth artists or early conceptualists, this is what they really felt, what they were, the primary thing that they were doing was that. I mean, not this, but the act of putting that up and making it. I myself didn't I did some kind of things outdoors in the 68, 69. And then actually I painted stripes in the landscape, literally with a paintbrush, like 3 feet wide for an hour. I painted a stripe. And then one of the stripes, I started from sunrise to sunset. I had a paintbrush, a bunch of buckets of paint, and I painted the color of the sky on the ground with the paintbrush from sunrise to sunset. So it was about 11 hours. I'm not sure, but it was about 11 hours painting in the fields until it went over a little stream. And then I thought, huh, this is interesting. It went over the stream. It doesn't exist anymore immediately.
You didn't try to paint the water?
I did. I dripped it in the water. I mean, I dripped it in the water, but it just went away. And the other stuff kind of at least had a tiny bit of permanence. You know, it stayed there. And so then after that, I decided to take my car, which I still have, and drive up the Delaware because do a whole thing in the water for an hour. And I didn't have any kind of motives or idea other than kind of going, walking through the water and dripping the paint and photographing it with my camera. And so I did, and I've just happened to stumble on Washington's Crossing, which gave it this other kind of dimension. And so I went in, dripped the paint, and I had the paint strapped to my belt, the gallons of paint, and it kind of pulled me under, and I had to get rid of the paint, I had to get rid of the camera to survive. And then I realized what I had was the story. Like, that's what was left. I didn't have any photographic documentation. I didn't have any paint left. I had the story to tell, which I'm not telling. And and that was it. And so why not fiction? Or why not the words being the thing? That's just me. That was me, in some sense, reacting against the kind of... Well, not really intentionally in a... It just... I wanted to make the photograph the thing rather than documentation. Anyway, the other part is chaos. The movement that there was two movements that preceded our generation that were in the 60s, and these two movements were almost like together, and they had a lot of things in common. The one was pop art. And the other one was minimal art. And both of them repeated things, repeated images, except that minimal was totally a non-objective pop art, used kind of images of culture. But it had to do, and Warhol did a lot of repeated images like minimalism did. In any case, minimalism seemed to be the thing, you know, we had to get out of. And by the way, there's this book that Dennis is in, not sure where it is at the moment, that is a lot of things of Dennis's is in. It's called Out of the Box, meaning by Carter Radcliffe. The idea that artists had to get out of this kind of white box that seemed to be almost like a prison. I mean, minimalist was pretty, I really respect it, and loved it in some ways as a student, but it was pretty fascistic. And that was what we had to get away from, unless we wanted to be second, third, fourth generation minimalists. So the other thing was chaos. Now, the interesting thing was the 60s were pretty chaotic, but minimalism wasn't. I like to interpret things in this kind of Nietzschean Apollo and Dionysius. The 60s were really Dionysian. Minimal art was Apollonian. By the way, the semiotics of Apollo include solidity, masculinity, culture, and control. We wanted to get out of the minimalist box, which seemed constraining and regimented, too much like the army. So we went for, and this is the late 60s, early 70s, Dionysius, the semiotics of liquidity, femininity, nature, and orgies. Just some examples in painting and films to give you an idea about the aesthetics of Dionysius and the aesthetics of Apollo. These are just metaphors, and by the way, the metaphors are kind of, you know, were pointed out by Nietzsche in 1872 with Birth of Tragedy. But Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy was probably the most influential single essay to artists throughout the 20th century with this Apollo and Dionysius. And you can see in a minute. Dionysius is Pollock strips. Apollo is the four straight lines that frame the drips and control, and the control he had in dripping. I'm going to read that again. Dionysius is Pollock's drips. I think at some point when he pulled up his hand from smushing the paintbrush on the canvas and just let it drip, that's when he became Pollock. And but in the end, there was this still these four straight lines that frame every one of his canvases that he stretched after he was finished. Heathcliff is Dionysius. Sir Edgar Linton is Apollo. I think that Emily Bronte understood this when she was writing Wuthering Heights. She had this one character, Heathcliff, nature, Dionysius, and this other guy, and this other guy, Edgar Linton, who she married, who was culture and masculinity and control. In Clockwork Orange, 1971, the two of them, Paul and Dionysius, are in conflict. I don't know if you remember Clockwork Orange, but you know, the guy who's still acting, Malcolm McDowell, is he had one eyelid like a made up with makeup, feminine, and the other eye was masculine. He kind of, you know, it was both in him, masculine and femininity. Anyway, Maud is Maud. I'm talking about Harold Maud here. Is Dionysius, and Harold's mother was Apollo. Harold had to choose. He chose a banjo, a combination of the two. In Lolita, this is maybe the best example, and I'm absolutely sure Nabokov read Nietzsche. Humbert, meaning umber, et cetera, male masculinity, is Apollo, and Claire Quilty, the rival, Claire, light femininity, it could be a woman's name, is Dionysius. At one point, they wrestle with each other. Lolita, whose last name was Hayes, which is kind of interesting because that's the in between light and dark, is caught between the two. But ultimately, runs off with Claire. And by the way, Nietzsche hoped that Dionysius would win. He admitted the kind of reality of both things, but if he was going to root for anyone, it was Dionysius. And that's what the 60s were kind of like, and culminating in Woodstock in 1969. And that slipped into the early 70s, and this work. In other words, you know, I would, for the most part, the semiotics of minimalism is Apollo. Control, straight line, and you know, everything, it's you, and also just making one decision and having the same space or a mathematical progression or a completely slick kind of impenetrable surface. And this was a response to that. It's just messier. I mean, you could have, well, maybe not there, but, you know, there's possibility of forest fires. When you kind of fool around with this, it's messier than minimalism. And I'm sure that it was a response to it in some way.
But even within your two, at the beginning, you were saying how conceptual.
Go ahead.
Okay. had two branches, and one was romantic and one was Marxist. Even that has the duality you just mentioned about Apollonian and Dionysian.
I would say in some sense, I mean, the Marxists seem to be a little bit more controlling it. It just depends. But I mean, the fact is that a lot of the Marxists were also romantics, which I think was a weird anomaly.
And a lot of Dionysians are Apollonian. I mean, but I'm just saying that the original dichotomy, which I kind of enjoyed when you mentioned it, that there were two schools under conceptualism, even that seems to have the same dichotomy about Apollo and, romantic in nature as opposed to controlled and controlling the market. And controlling, just an observation.
The one point I would really like to get across in that like kind of analogy is that it seemed to me that the Marxists, whoever they might have been, really did have an agenda that had to do with the political agenda and having to do with somehow getting rid of the galleries, or against the establishment getting rid of the galleries. I mean, this was definitely talked about and part of the discourse of the time. I never understood like what the kind of alternative. You know, you have to go on living, and what that alternative was. But I don't think. I've known Dennis since 1970, and I just don't think he was a kind of an agenda person. And to his credit, and but there were people that were working with ethereal materials. I mean, that piece just doesn't exist anymore. And so, I mean, we don't have it, or we have this other kind of substitute, which probably is a little less than the real thing. If you were standing there, and. Both sides did these ethereal things, but the one I believed had more of an agenda for these certain ends than some of the artists already did, at least in the groups of different people that I knew and met at the time. I might be naive, and maybe there's always an agenda, but. I didn't feel it as much with Dennis as other people in that sense. Much of Dennis's work had to do with Dionysius, and if you look at it, with water, air, and fire, and certainly with nature. But it was not always one or the other. Most often, it is a tension or balance between the two. Excuse me. On the surface, digital photography, pixels, is Apollonian, and analog photographs with their burnt silver grain are Dionysian. But it is not as simple as that. I just put that out. But when, in the 70s, when that was actually really taken, that was taken with an analog camera. And we only had analog cameras. An analog camera meaning you have a lens, and then the light comes through it, and you open up the lens to whatever kind of degree you need to, and then the light comes in and burns silver. And these little silver things, the little particles like that are floating around in this emulsion, are frozen in this emulsion. Like some of them get burnt. Like if I had an analog camera here and I was just aiming it this way, there would be two real big burn spots right here. They would be black, just like if you lit a log on fire, the log turns black, and so the film does. And so then when it gets put in the enlarger, that part becomes white. But what's getting burnt is like these little pieces of silver, and they're very irregular. My own feeling of this is that they're Dionysian. Where digital photography is pixels, it's very regimented. I'm not putting down digital photography. There's my camera, one of them. And even though I shoot with a old 4x5 in my studio, it still gets transferred into a digital file. And it's much better and it's much easier. And I think it's more complicated than this, but I felt that way about Apollo and Dionysius and analog and digital photography. In the 70s, radicality in art had to do with the temporary and the ephemeral quality, as well as the use of language. Language that was in the work itself, often the only thing in the work. The language did not function merely as titles or art criticism traditionally did. The language was the art. Today, this is not a new idea. If you can believe it, there was a time when people felt a little strange about seeing something on the wall that was called art that was only language. Now, this, of course, totally relies on the language. Like, I'm talking about formal language. But it also has photographic detail and things like that in the back. But people like Joseph Kossuth and Art and Language just put language on the wall. And that, at the time, was radical. Felt it. Fins were radical. Dennis must have loved them because he had two, not one, but two, I think, 1956 Chevys with beautiful fins. And I was in one of them not that long ago. The Cadillacs outdid the Chevys till their fins were high as a 747. Fins at the time felt radical. I mean, actually, the bigger the fin, the more radical the design. And the reason that they were using fins, I suppose, was because cars were meant to kind of look like airplanes. I mean, you don't really need fins in cars. You definitely need them in an airplane. And so the bigger the fin, the cooler the car. And then at some point, the Cadillac fins were like really ridiculously large. And then they kind of, I lived through it because I kind of liked cars. And I thought, now they're getting smaller. And smaller, and how can they kind of get away with this? Like, because isn't radical big? And the question is then, where do we go? Same thing happened in the opposite way with skirts at the time. In the 60s, they got shorter and shorter, which seemed radical, until they evolved into very conservative belts. In other words, at a certain point when a skirt is short, like it's a belt. And then again, you question, okay, where can we go from here? It's not a moral statement, it's just an aesthetic statement. In the 60s and early 70s, radicality was the photograph as art, equal to painting and sculpture. So the other thing that was radical at the time, besides language, was the fact that actual people were accepting art galleries that normally showed painting and sculpture, not photography, not Stieglitz and Minor White and those people, but showed galleries that showed painting and sculpture were now showing photographs, and they believed that it was art on the same level as painting and sculpture. And now, I was just at the opening for the Whitney last night for the 40th anniversary of the project show. It's just painting, sculpture, photographs. It doesn't matter. It's totally accepted. That was not possible in 1969-70. Photography status as art was questionable then. It is taken for granted now. And see if you agree with this. It is the status of art itself that is questioned now. And I'm going to go to now. That was then in the 70s. Now I just want to like kind of bring it to 2011 and the semiotics of what we have of radicality now. Uh, the subcultures of conceptual art called earth art and body art might have less impact now than they did in the late 60s and early 70s for a number of reasons. And the idea of radicality has changed. In the 70s, it was considered radical to make something that was difficult to sell. Now the market may be the message. Umberto Eco, in his theory of semiotics, defines a sign as anything that has the capacity to lie. Although photography has lied since the beginning with its images of ghosts and fairies, it is now much easier to pull off a goblin. I am not saying anything derogatory about the digital photography of today. I use it all the time. A medium becomes more sophisticated the more it can lie, because it becomes more independent of the referent. And then I have the sentence here, the King of France is bald. What I'm trying to say here is that it was easy in the past to make something that wasn't true with photography, although we believed since basically the light kind of comes from somewhere, bounces off of someone, and then comes into the camera, and then burns the film, you believe that it's true. But people still had like different ways of they made fairies and they made ghosts and other things. All I had to do is take this camera here and just kind of aim it right this way, and then go home to my son and say, well, there was only one person in the room. I mean, you know, it depends on what lens you have. I mean, of course, it can tell and can lie is tell the truth, but it's important that it can lie, because this, I think, in some sense, depends on the fact that it's true, that it existed at some, one point. What I'm trying to say here is that I think it was really good that this was done in 1974, because if someone just came up with the idea now, you might think Photoshop. And who cares? Maybe. I mean, in other words, I think that this art, which was really the most important art of the time, was lucky in the sense that it was believable and it was analog photography. And now, I mean, you can go out and do earthworks now. First of all, there's still people that are doing it. I don't get, like, even sometimes when they're pretty good, so kind of turned on from them, just because they've already been kind of done. But it's also possible just to totally, I mean, that's really easy to fake in Photoshop. And that's one thing that's different now than in the past. And so I'm not sure if we would have a kind of art that would depend on the fact that something that was done and it's true. The King of France is bald. I just said it. And you understand what it means. But there's no King of France, so it's totally irrelevant that he's bald. But it still has meaning. And so, in other words, language, the English, in this case, the English language, is capable of saying the King of France is bald. And it has meaning, and you don't choke when you say it because, you know, you're telling a lie. That's a lie. I mean, because language, I mean, that's what fiction is all about. You know, telling lies that really work. And I think now that's also what photography can be about. We don't necessarily have to believe it, and maybe we never did. Except I kind of believe that existed. It has to do with the context as well, when it was done and who did it. A work like Radicality can easily be made digitally without having to venture outside the studio or even light a match. The radicality of 1970s earthworks had to do with actually believing the works were originally done in the materials you saw in the photographs, that an artist actually went outside and dug a hole or lit a match. Michael Heiser's trenches in the desert were the awaiting graves of minimal art. In early conceptualism, analog photography was the means to an end, as it functioned in Dennis's radicality. The real work was somewhere out on exit 52. This soon changed. Even in the early 70s, some so-called narrative artists posed the photo as the end in itself, not as documentation. The so-called picture generation ran with it from there, but that's another story. Ideas and objects also go in and out of radicality. Take the banjo, for example. Having been in the 1850s, a radically innovative instrument imported from Africa, it soon became the archetypal American instrument. Then it fell out of favor in hip circles and rock and roll until recently when Jack White, Mumford & Sons, Gillian Welch, and the Decemberists took it up, and it sounds quite fresh. Phil Glass should consider the banjo. Adagio for five banjos, one could be Steve. Imagine a hookup with Phil Glass and Steve Martin. Radical. Because of the 60s, the semiotics of radicality was youth and long hair. The longer the hair, the more implied radicalism. I don't know if some of you might remember this, but it did actually. Long hair, like short skirts, and were statements. And the longer the hair, the more radical you seemed. It seemed not no longer work. My son, by the way, he's 17. He has hair like to here. And it looks nice. And I'm not, like, shocked or there's no problem, and it's neither is my father, who's 90. Because of the 60s, the semiotics of radicality was youth and long hair. The longer the hair, the more implied radicalism. Now with the Tea Party, which is truly a radical group, because they want to bring down the government, the semiotics of radicality is wrinkles and gray hair, long and short. The Wall Street movement demonstrating today may be hampered by deja vu. I actually went down there a couple weeks ago. It was great. I totally sympathized with them. But basically, it was like one little kind of piece of Woodstock in 1969. All they needed is about, 300,000 more people, and it would have been the same thing. But the visual semiotics were really close to 1969. I might advise them to wear suits and still have the same thing to say. A radical has become an expletive, like awesome. Are like far out, which, by the way, was one of Dennis's favorite thing to say, was far out. When you have a word like awesome, it kind of doesn't mean awesome anymore. It just means that's pretty good, I like it, or something like that. Same thing has happened with the word radical. I mean, the word my sons use the word radical, it doesn't probably have the same meaning as it might have in 1974. Take the idea of beauty, which was considered retrograde, immoral, or even worse, inappropriate, for decades, at least in the context of art. Then Dave Hickey and a couple of others, including myself, revisited in the 90s. It seemed radical, even to mention it. I had a conversation with Louise Bourgeois about it, and also with Dennis, about the sublime. And to be honest, it felt radical. Actually, we did not have the word inappropriate in the 70s, to our credit. In our present discourse of 2011, inappropriate has come to mean, quotation marks, not acceptable by we who are the majority and who are presently in power in any circumstance, now are in the future, and we are, by the way, descendants of the politically correct and consequently correct in our judgments. Quotation marks. But we did have the word radicality in the 70s. Radicality meant not acceptable by most of the people in power who are in fact not us, and appreciated by only a few, so we are bound together through this appreciation. But radicality is something that someday may be worthwhile to more than just a few, and therefore radicality may transform society in a positive, expansive sense, or so we hope. Dennis's radicality must have been beautiful in real life, possibly even sublime. I wish I could have seen it burn. So now I don't have anything more, if you have any comments or questions about anything. And I would really wouldn't mind taking up, what you possibly think radicality could mean now. In the case of hair, I think you'd have to be incredibly creative. But with everything else, what could radicality mean to us in 2011?
Being humane.
Okay.
Are you speaking politically or within the art world or socially? It's a broad question.
It's a broad question, and I think in the 70s, certainly radicality, and I think Dennis must have been aware in the 70s that there was political radicality, as well as, quotation marks, in the art world. And hopefully, they do kind of go back and forth, and that something in the art world just doesn't simply only stay in the art world and never, gets out with anyone else. And even if the artist's intent is to be overtly political or not. Kazimir Malevich painted a kind of white square and a white background and our squares, and he really believed that those squares, they didn't say anything, they were just squares. He believed that they were part of the radicality of the Russian Revolution and that they would effect change. Ironically, Stalin's kind of minions told him to start painting figures again and made him less radical as a painter. And there's the one painting of Malevich that is just stripes. It's just stripes, like Kenneth Noland, in 1917. And he had to kind of paint little horses and call it the Charge of the Red Guard. He had to add those figurative things. He wasn't allowed to just paint stripes, which were thought of as being radical and were radical at the time. White on White was probably radical in 1917. Painting a painting of a white square balanced on a white background. It's up at the Museum of Modern Art. What could radicality be now? Again, I totally agree. I'm sympathetic to what's going on today with the marches and things like that. I don't know if I need to call it radical.
I suppose that radicality, given what you said, would be of necessity outside the art world. Outside the art world. It would have to extend from the art world into the real world. Is that a...
It often does.
Yeah.
It often goes from the art world to the real world. I think that probably all the artists, not only the ones with the really conscious, strict political agendas, but the other artists as well, hoped... And even if they hope or not, it probably does extend out into the real world. I mean, I don't know how political cubism was, what the political motives of it was, but imagine a world without it.
Well, I'm not sure that being in the real world requires being political. I'm not sure that being in the real world requires being political. I am sure that it requires moving out of the art world, and I think that we in the art world here and need to ask why it is that we don't get out into the real world substantively. I mean, that's a very provocative image, and it's certainly outdoors, and somehow would be, if it were in the real world, would be a very important message.
Okay, I agree. I mean, it does seem to be problematic as far as, like, coming up with something radical stylistically. I mean, that's what the book, The Shock of the New, was about. Or The Shock of the Old, I forget what it was called. The Shock of the New. And, you know, I mean, and that's basically when people felt that, it also seemed to be the beginning of the, quotation marks, postmodern era. When people felt that they couldn't, there was nothing left to shock in a visual way. And then artists had to, in the postmodern era, like find other, I don't know, kind of ways, other strategies, which they did. I suppose so. I'm being positive in that sense. I don't, you know, I.
Could you define what is radical? It's an overused term. You've already said that, but could radical mean that you've stretched your ideas so far that it brings you to a place where the world changes, you see something new? It might not be shocking, it might be expansive, it might be giving birth to a new thing. That could be radical. You could be blown away, like Dennis's term, far out. It's not, you're not paralyzed by that insight.
First of all, I think that expansive is really a really positive and good word to be associated with radicality, because often when something is radical, whether it's personal or political or something like that, it does make you a larger person. Mm-hmm. And but you also really feel it. Like, yeah. It's not something that you just kind of goes by. There was a feeling at the time that this was different, what was going on. I felt it in different ways, you know, since then, but not like that. I mean, there was a real feeling that something was really changing or different, and that's one of the reasons why it's possible that. I don't know if it's necessary to categorize things like this, but it's possible that it was the last of the modern kind of attitude, where people actually, if you can believe it or not, got shocked at like space being, you know, not that expansive like Renaissance. They were shocked by cubism, and they were shocked by suprematism, And I know the first time I was in Philadelphia at the time, there was a couple times I was shocked by art previous to what I did. I didn't mean it that way. Standing on Carl Andre's, I was standing in Philadelphia Museum, standing on his flat 144 squares. And I was reading the thing, and I didn't realize I was standing on it. Then I realized I was standing on it like I was standing on the art. And I was shocked. And I was also shocked a bit by Donald Judd's tubes, square tubes, in Leo Castelli's gallery, I think, I don't know when it was, in the late 60s, when I came up to New York to see it. And, you know, maybe to, I'm really being honest now here. Since then, I've hardly been shocked, but I've been pissed off a couple times. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of pissed off about appropriation. You know, it's okay for one idea. It was okay, really great for the snow shovel and the things that Duchamp appropriated, but like to have like 10 years of it, it's kind of a boring idea. You can appropriate this, you can appropriate that, you can appropriate, and you can go on appropriating things. And I'm going to these symposiums at the Museum of Modern Art at the moment on photography, like they're one every few months, where they invite some people that use photographs to come and talk. There's about 100 people. And I would say it's mostly kind of fairly younger people, and I would say 70%, 50%, 60%, 70%. Basically, appropriation is the new academy. I mean, and they were like going on and on about, there was some court case that where like the appropriated artists like actually won the case, and they were really sweating it out that like if they would have lost it, what would have happened to the whole kind of movement? But music is controlled a little bit more. I mean, you can't take like three bars of the Beatles and
that is all about mixing and
really that much? I thought there was a limit. I think I'm not sure about it, but I'm not. You know, my sister is in more music, but there's a limit to what you can take. And Jeff Koons got in trouble. Like, he took a postcard and made a sculpture. I mean, the sculpture was in color. The postcard was in black and white. The sculpture was three-dimensional. I don't think he should have gotten in trouble. But he lost. But now I'm going to say something. I was just at not the last one, but the one before this. Sarah Charlesworth appropriated the My Life. I mean, not the My the girl running naked in Vietnam. I mean, she seemed to kind of saying she was that it was hers. So I'm not sure if that shocked me, but I'm talking about something recent that kind of slightly pissed me off. And maybe being pissed off is the same as being shocked. So maybe it works. who said that? I didn't see where that came from. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. That's the other great thing. And maybe you know the person I'm paraphrasing it here. But it's easy to shock the bourgeoisie. It's really easy. All you have to do is shit in a can and put a lid on it and call it, you know, what, shit. And I'm not putting that down either. I really like it. And Armand did all those things where he put the garbage in the plexi. It's and then people pay a lot of money to like have a piece like of garbage in their. And again, I'm totally sympathetic to this, but it's fairly easy to shock the bourgeoisie. What's really interesting, and someone said this, I'm not sure who it was, it probably wasn't Apollinaire, but it's one thing to shock to be able to shock the bourgeoisie, but to shock the avant-garde is what's really interesting.
Right. When did that last happen?
Do you know who said that, though? No. I've been trying to find... I could give a couple examples.
Actually, just a couple of days ago, Marina Abramovich, staged that whole thing in Mocha there, and Yvonne Rainer, where I guess you have to consider avant-garde, and a whole bunch of co-signers were totally aghast at the grotesqueness and the exploitation. We all know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Okay. So how recently was the avant-garde shot? 5 days ago?
Was it only five? Because I thought she did those performances like a year ago or something like that.
Well,
and she kind of
cut. No.
Oh.
And that brings up, I don't know if we're still on radicality, but something.
We are still in radicality here.
No.
Well, go ahead. Please.
Okay. One of the things that you had mentioned earlier on was the idea of whether seabed
could be done by someone else. It was. It was done by Marina Abramovic.
Yeah, I was totally aware of that.
And, but no, but I don't
it obviously was transformed somewhat in that.
Well, it was a female orgasm, not a male one, but and it was it was done in the rotunda, in a round space, under a plaid. I mean, you know, the staging was different.
No,
everything. But that's I'm tying these two things together.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
And we might be straying from radicality, but the idea of the authenticity when you restage performance is something that's of interest to me. Because that's, I think, the problem that Abramovic is getting into and why she's having problems with people like Yvonne Rainer, who say, how can you hire these people to be, you know, in low-wage positions to basically do this endurance art and to be under the gaze of other people and to suffer, et cetera, which they wouldn't say if she was doing it herself, because then it's her choice, her body. But when you start becoming an empresario and start saying, I'm going to have my work restaged, or I'm going to stage work like mine, but other people are going to be the slaves, those who do it.
So, I don't like the slave part at all. But I admit that I didn't go see her performances of Vito's piece, The Seedbed, and things like that.
The seven dead, whatever it was called, seven.
Yeah. Again, I
Five Easy Pieces it was called, actually.
Yeah.
But it was actually was called Seven Easy Pieces after the film Five Easy Pieces.
Yeah.
Okay. At the Guggenheim, what, about 5 years ago?
Yeah.
4 years
ago? It's very possible that someone that's, 20, 21, 22 could be, you know, not having either heard of or seeing the original things could be kind of happy and thrilled by that. I wasn't. But, I mean, I didn't see it either, so it's not really fair.
I was going to just take it one step further, and maybe we're getting far away from what you want to be talking about, but for me, the idea of restaging has to do less with art than with institutionalization of art. Because the whole reason to restage performance is so that it will always be around and there will always be someone there to curate it and museums to collect it. So it gets into the commodity aspect. And we're coming around because we're talking about ephemerality and collectability of art that was considered not to be collectible, and precisely because it was ephemeral. And so the relic, the photo, the memory, whatever, was not a collectible object. You were confounding the system by not producing for it, which we've learned, of course, as Vito said, that they were wrong. Not wrong to do it, but they were wrong in the supposition that you can create something that someone wouldn't want to collect. Because apparently anything can be collected. And even performances can be collected and can be restaged, so a museum can own a performance.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
but it's not. It can never be original, and therefore it can never be radical. Because those two things, there's originality connected with radicality.
You want the mic?
Yeah, the whole idea about appropriation, which irritates you, which irritates me tremendously. I remember that one piece that you dressed yourself like George Washington and a photograph, and it was like so much better than anything Cindy Sherman ever did, and I think you did once and you moved on and you did other things. But restaging, you can't, it's not an original act. Appropriation is not original in it. I mean, in a kernel, I suppose it is. It's not an original idea, therefore it can't have radical impact.
I feel the same way. Yeah,
okay, but
totally.
But what for the is there no value for the public who never experienced the other? It can never be replicated outside of the commodification of it. Yeah.
Because it's not original within its own time.
It doesn't matter. What matters is what the ripple effects, in my opinion.
It matters how it affects the receiver, the audience, so to speak, whoever is benefiting or involved or engaged with the art. And this goes to the heart of, you know, coming from Los Angeles and being associated with Rachel Rosenthal, who was associated with Bob Rauschenberg and Jesper Johns in the 50s. He moved to Los Angeles. He's a performance artist. She's an amazing actress. And her scripts are incredible. Yet she's going to die someday. She's 85. And yet those scripts should live on. And I know that's kind of theater-oriented. But something like that, doing that and having the flares and going out to Long Island or any place in the country and doing that, seems to me it could be relevant to the people who are experiencing it for the first time. And it doesn't matter what the art history is. It doesn't matter whether it's original. It doesn't matter what can be sold. It matters to the receiver, to the people experiencing that cultural spark.
By the way, that is a very eloquent postmodern attitude, in the sense that the meaning is within the person that receives the message, and not in the intent of the person that produces the message. Yeah, and the interesting thing, the difference between maybe Vito's performances and some of Dennis's, and Mozart and Chopin, who also did things that were ethereal that ended, and I mean they wrote things, they probably were aware that someday they were going to be dead, and so they wrote it as music, and it was intended to be done by other people. In the case of some of the performance art, it seems, I mean, the intent seemed to be all right. Joseph Beuys, we could do another Joseph Beuys with the dog and the wolf or whatever it is, and the hat and stuff like that. You'd have to really figure out who to get for the Joseph Beuys part. Yeah, but you're right. But the thing is, you're right. Not anyone. No, Joseph Beuys wasn't anyone. They don't have those eyes. They don't have those eyes. And that's what, they don't have those eyes. Yeah, Joseph Beuys' eyes.
All right, maybe he had the ear.
No. But in some sense, that's what theater and the films and movies, I mean, they take it for granted that this is an ethereal thing. And I think it's in some sense how performance art evolved into being, if performance art, Vito gave his permission for Seedbed. And I think he was happy to get the press now, how many, 40 years after it was done. It still lives. We're still talking about it.
The question is whether there's a shamanistic value to the original person who formulated something.
There certainly is with Joseph Beuys. And
I think there's a lot. I mean, then you start getting into cult of personality. My point is that there's a decision to be made across the board, possibly, whether...
It doesn't matter to me. But.
Hi.
It actually distorts it a little bit.
Yeah, I'll keep it far away. The question is whether... In the question of restaging, obviously it talks about the question of authenticity. It talks about the question of the intentionality of the artist. It talks about the shamanistic quality of the artist. That only, if someone comes up with a performance and acts it out, whether it's Chris Burden on the Volkswagen, scream. I mean,
that would be an interesting one.
No, what I'm saying is, if you can restage one, you can restage any. And I don't. Fair enough.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Peter.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Amy.
Something I've been meaning to mention about the song that you did, there was a collaborative nature to that thing. I mean, and it's you as a group of artists being downtown and realizing something important was happening in the world of art and the world in general, and kind of gathering yourselves together, and then saying, okay, let's go up to the sound studio and let's do this song together as a group. And so I think that's somehow, that has a little bit, that kind of has a radical nature to it, the idea of the collective, that a collective can be formed for a purpose, as opposed to the individual artist working in the studio, the importance of the collective. And
that's what we see out here now in New York. It's kind of the group coming together. And even these things that happen spontaneously, there's a text message, and it's go somewhere and participate in a dance in a place. There's a name, probably other people know the name for that activity when they call a group. So there's something about the collective that kind of strengthens the possibility for radicality, because they're kind of, there's strength in numbers.
That's a really good comment, and it's a way to kind of maybe even conclude. I didn't mention this, but there was a kind of collaborative kind of feel, and one of the places where it was felt the strongest was 112 Greene Street.
Right.
And I mean, you really, I don't know, some of us hardly knew each other, and by the way, it was pretty much men and women together, and it felt, I mean, what joined us was the idea of art. In other words, we thought we were making art, and we also thought it was kind of radical in the materials that were being used. But this, it was a kind of a, even though we didn't even sometimes get to know each other that well, there was a kind of a collaborative, kind of very good feeling about it, which lasted for about 3 years and 4 years, and then it became something else. And that was like 70, 71, and 72, and 73. It's very possible it's like that now. I just don't know about it, or it's somewhere else. But that the collaborative part of it. And it's also, by the way, one of the places where I met and where Dennis worked.
Yeah. I think it might be productive to actually go back to the work itself. And in that work, you actually find these questions posed perhaps with more subtlety. You can even see the word radicality inscribed on the surface of the earth between two lines. And what that suggests is that there's a negotiation of the very question of what constitutes radicality that's already in the work. The work is itself a question. And the nature of a question is that it's a process of perpetual interrogation, a process of perpetual questioning. So already in the beginning of the work is this notion that there cannot be one thing that constitutes radicality. There's not one answer to the question. And so the work, in a way, represents not... It's not a photograph. I think we should be quite clear that we can read it materially. We can read it in relationship to the as an image that can be sold or not sold, but that actually isn't that radical a reading. In fact, what's radical about it is that it's an open question, and that question doesn't ever conclude or reach a conclusion. It's just a perpetual negotiation. And so it's not so much a question of what will constitute radicality today. It's how can we support this perpetual process of thinking about what constitutes radicality, not with the notion that there's an answer and we ourselves will be the only author of that, but rather that, as Amy was saying, that there's a multitude of ways of thinking about radicality. There will not be one way, and we should do what we can to be part of, as Dennis's surrogate suggests in lecture number one, with which we began today, that that our task is to be investigators. The task of artists is to be investigators, and that investigators have to unionize, as he said, and create some collective movement of investigation. So it's on that note.
I have one more thing. This morning, I found something that I felt a tiny little bit of radicality in the New York Times today, and it was because here's the pictures here, and it's because you can now, really, right now, take this and take this off the camera or any place else, and you can put this on this. I don't know, I felt it was kind of radical. Anything, any Canon lens you can put on an iPhone.
We began with lecture number one this morning because in lecture number one, again, is this notion of a union of investigation that is that begins with the surrogate, but actually over the course of today's proceedings becomes all of our responsibility to uphold. This union of investigation would be it would become our project, all of our projects. And on that note, we have bow ties for all of you. And these bow ties inaugurate you into the union of investigation. And of course, although we thus end with this disbursement, this dispersal of bow ties, the idea is that the union kind of actually just begins to take off in this moment, and that the work just begins, the work of perpetually questioning what constitutes radicality. So Amy's going to hand out these bow ties, and with that gesture, she's going to inaugurate you into the union of investigation, and then we all become live surrogates.
Okay, sure. Even to my son. Nice.